everyone who loves books. This is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, your weekly compendium of the best in books and reading. I'm your host Red Sail, and coming up in this week's show, we're going transatlantic with some great contemporary tales from America. Tessa Fontaine tells us about running away to join the circus in her memoir, The Electric Woman.
It was so simple. You're just using your body as a conduit for electricity, so you don't really do much. But it's incredibly beautiful and bizarre to watch.
Paul Burchard recounts the amazing story of the boy who played with fusion.
And they make a new helium atom, which is just a little bit heavier, but it lets off quite a bit of energy when they do that, when the two fuse together.
Deborah Harkness talks about transforming a discovery of witches from best-selling books to primetime TV.
Something I took me 2 pages to describe, they can show in a second and a half, is a real treat.
That's all coming up in today's Read On. After her mother suffered a series of catastrophic strokes, Tessa Fontaine struggled to cope with her feelings. So she left to join America's last traveling circus sideshow and learned to perform death-defying acts. The Electric Woman is her life-affirming memoir of finding hope and companionship among sword swallowers and snake charmers.
The Snake Charmer. Day 7 of 150. World of Wonders. June 2013. I've just finished Windexing the glass in front of Queen Kong, our giant taxidermy gorilla, when Tommy pops his head into the tent. "You ready to meet the snakes?" he asks. The night before, Tommy had gone to negotiate the purchase of 2 giant boa constrictors from some guy in town. I didn't know who or where they came from, or how Tommy knew these snakes were safe to handle, but I knew they were being delivered to our show today.
Tessa joined me via Skype from her home in North Carolina. Tessa Fontaine, welcome to Read On.
Thanks so much for having me.
So the book starts with you setting light to yourself and learning how to become a fire eater and performer. In the first couple of chapters, it becomes very clear that this is no soft ride. You are actually putting yourself in some degree of danger, aren't you?
Yes, yes, absolutely. Eating fire is not necessarily the safest activity to perform. What's more than that, a lot of the acts that a person performs with a traveling sideshow are actually quite dangerous. They look dangerous, and in fact, they are dangerous. So yeah, it was quite harrowing.
And the snakes. You're not a big fan of snakes, are you?
Not a big fan of snakes. Yeah, I thought that I had just kind of a regular, sort of neutral distaste for snakes, and that once I, was kind of face to face with them, I would just be able to get over that and be totally fine around these snakes. But the night before our show opened, I finally got to meet our 2 snakes that we'd have for the season, 2 giant red-tailed boa constrictors. And every impulse in my body was just trying to, it was like I didn't have control over my limbs. My body was just trying to escape from the truck where I was meeting them. And that was really a problem because I was the new snake charmer. And so starting in the next morning, I was supposed to have them wrapped around my neck and be charming them for, 14 or 16 hours a day on stage. So that was a real issue.
It really is quite a trial by ordeal. And you make it clear in the book that really you were struggling to cope with your mother's illness, weren't you?
Yeah, I was, absolutely. My mom suffered a series of massive strokes, and she lost her ability to talk and walk and was really sick. We didn't think that she would survive, actually. And in fact, she sort of went to the other side and came back a few times. It didn't seem like there was a way forward. And yet she was kind of stuck in this really difficult place where she, didn't really have control of any external expression anymore. And it was really heartbreaking to see. And And it kind of happened at the same time that my parents lost their house, and it just was incredibly stressful. And I didn't really know what to do or how to be helpful. And it sort of threw me into a great emotional whirlwind.
And I think that struggle to be a good carer is something that will resonate with a lot of our listeners and their families. As you say, it's very difficult to do something practical and also to keep your morale up. And yet, in some ways, it was actually very good training for the death-defying stunts that you ended up taking on at the sideshow.
Yeah, that's true. I think that they, in really surprising ways, ended up sort of communicating with each other and you know, requiring some of the same skills, which I think sort of the biggest thing that I learned out there, or learned in both situations really, was when you're caring for someone who's really, really severely, you know, physically and mentally disabled, and like, it's going, like, it was really hard, and sometimes it was painful. I mean, it was often painful for her, and watching that was incredibly hard. And sometimes it was painful for me, and it was physically difficult and, you know, sad. And yet it was also full of incredible tenderness and joy. And the thing was, one just had to stick through the really bad times. Like, there wasn't a choice about running away. And that was the same thing that I learned in the sideshow, especially for a lot of these really dangerous acts. Like, the way that you eat fire is you eat fire. You just put the fire in your mouth, and it is going to be uncomfortable, and it is going to burn you a little bit, but you just learn to sit with the pain and withstand the pain. And so, yeah, absolutely. I think the skills that I learned in both of those environments really, really informed the other.
And the repetitive nature of having to perform repeatedly, hour after hour, during a 14-hour day, 7 days a week for, well, it was a six-month season, wasn't it? It was 150 days on the road.
Right, exactly. Yeah, the repetitive nature was a really surprising part of the challenge. Just doing the same acts over and over again and not, you know, we didn't take any rests, we didn't take any breaks. We didn't even have a day off or half of a day off or anything. So, yeah, it was both like incredibly treacherous and boring, which is a really strange combination of things. And yet I think that in some ways that's what, I mean, my all these years of like kind of the sustained emergency and illness that happened after my mom had her strokes, because she, you know, continually would get infections in her brain and her body and with seizures and had so many medical complications, I think 11 brain surgeries. And so it was both constant emergency, and yet like sort of anything becomes kind of normalized over time. And so when there wasn't an extreme emergency, you know, we were just living our normal lives, which was a different version of the lives than we had lived before. But that was a really strange piece, that it was like boring to be backstage, and then, you know, you'd walk out and swallow a sword, which is an incredibly dangerous thing to do, and then be bored again immediately. In fact, something would happen to me sometimes, and I would realize I would like be totally spacing out, like just thinking about something completely different, not paying attention at all. And I would like sort of come to, like, wake up, sort of like when you're driving and you kind of zone out or something. I would come to, and I would be on stage in front of a huge crowd of people, you know, doing something like sitting on an electric chair. And it was this really bizarre moment of like realizing that I could kind of just automatically perform some of these feats after, you know, so many months of doing them and so many times doing them so many times a day. And it was a struggle to have to be really present in each performance. Every single time we did each one, the performance was better when I was actually present, of course, and, you know, paying more attention to the audience and doing a better job on stage. And yet being present, completely present for, you know, 14 or 16 hours a day is really hard. So yeah, that was definitely a strange part of being out there.
And you narrated The Electric Woman yourself. Was that something that you foresaw yourself doing?
I really hoped that I would be able to narrate the audiobook. I wasn't sure how it worked with the publishers or if they, you know, wanted a professional actor. But I guess especially with memoir, they sometimes they like to have the author do it. And I think because, you know, I had been a performer with the show and before that, they maybe trusted me more than they should have. But I love giving readings and I love kind of being able to read my work. It's so intoxicating to feel like you're telling a story with the pacing and with the timing that you really have the audience's attention. And so I loved the idea of being able to do that for the audiobook and to be able to, you know, really authentically put some of the emotion into the reading and the pacing and, you know, try very poorly to do a little bit of some of the voices of the people that I knew out there. And I had a really, really great time doing it and lost my voice a few days, but really loved the experience.
And you must be delighted that you can actually bring the book to life for a lot of people who are not print enabled, whether through sight loss or not being able to read.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's the best sort of possible scenario, that it's, you know, not just someone else reading the book, but that I can sort of tell the story, which also I think, like, you know, the sideshow itself, it's very visual, of course, but it's also so much about the sounds, the way that people's voices kind of carry the stories of what you're seeing and the way that storytelling, you know, continues to reveal what the acts are over time and how it changes. And so it feels like that is the same thing that happens with an audiobook, where I'm sort of honoring the tradition of the sideshow and being able to share the story with, yeah, all kinds of folks who would listen to it on audio rather than print. So, yeah, it was really one of the best parts.
So, yes, tell us about The Electric Woman of the title.
Yeah. The Electric Chair Act was the last act that I learned, The Electric Woman, and it was also my most favorite to perform. The basic idea is there is an electric chair on stage, and there's someone who kind of introduces the chair. We had a performer with us named Red Stewart, actually, who he would kind of do this preamble, like, there are this many electric chairs left in the United States, and, you know, this was their purpose, and this is how much wattage goes through them. And then he would invite me out on stage, and I would sit down in the electric chair, and he would flip the switch, it would flip the electricity on, and then he would hand me a series of light bulbs and would light them off of my arms and my legs. And then part of our, like, sort of gimmick was that I would have a light bulb hidden in my costume, and he would sort of turn around and pretend like it's over, and then I would put that light bulb in my mouth and would light it up in my mouth. And then once he touched the light bulb in my mouth, that it completed the electrical circuit, and so it would shine even brighter. And I loved this act because it was so simple. You're just using your body as a conduit for electricity. So you don't really do much. But it's incredibly beautiful and bizarre to watch a human body, you know, light up a light bulb. It doesn't make any sense. It seems like it must be really painful, which it's not very painful. You only feel some sparks or some sort of buzzing in your body if it's raining, like if there's a lot of moisture in the air, which was always a little concerning. But for the most part, it doesn't hurt, and it's really magical. And, you know, I would always look down and see this little row of faces by the stage, like usually some kids up front, and they would just be so wide-eyed and wide-mouthed and totally amazed by this, by seeing something that doesn't really make sense to see. And so that was a really wonderful part of being in the show, of being part of something that seems impossible. It seems like a body shouldn't be able to do this particular thing, and yet there you are doing it.
You call it in the book a world of illusion and danger. It certainly seems to contain both. And there are people who just devote their lives to working in these sideshows. There are some amazing characters in there. I particularly enjoyed Snickers, the kind of man who can turn himself into knots. And,
right.
And Red, who is truly the kind of man your mother might have warned you against talking to, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I think at first he comes across as kind of the most typical, stereotypical carny who, you know, he's been out on the road for like 40, 50 years, and he lives in his van, and he's completely covered in tattoos, and he doesn't have any teeth, and he's so gruff. He's so mean and gruff and rude when you first meet him. And I learned, it took me a while before I learned that part of the reason he's like that is just because he's been on the road for so long, and he's seen so many performers come and go, people who came out, you know, to try to be a performer and couldn't make it, couldn't last a season, thought it was too hard, thought the work was too exhausting or painful, and so left. So he has this sort of strategy, which is that he doesn't learn anyone's name. He just doesn't care, doesn't, you know, make eye contact, just could care less who you are until you have proven yourself out there, until you have stayed out there long enough, or, you know, worked really hard for a sustained period of time, until you become someone in his orbit who is a valuable member of the team in some sort of long-term way. And then he was full of stories. And I mean, he would come backstage and like sing Judy Garland while he would brush his long orange hair. And I mean, he ended up being one of my very favorite people out there.
And I should share with the audience, this is a man who bangs nails up his nostrils as part of his stage show.
He does. He bangs nails up his nostrils, and he weaves big, thick pins, like sharp pins, through his skin in a Dr. Frankenstein act. And he holds just about every world record for sword swallowing, like the most at once. And he regularly swallows a car axle. And I mean, he just does incredibly harmful and frightening things to his body. Yeah.
Yes, don't try this at home.
Don't.
And I mean, in some ways, earning his respect is one of the things that kept driving you along. But actually, you say something very interesting at the beginning of the book. Had you turned down your opportunity to play with the sideshow, as the co-founder says to you, actually, you wouldn't have been able to face your mum, you said. It was her adventurous spirit that really drove you to join the sideshow and keep on succeeding there.
Yeah, it really did. That's right. She was a really, yes, very adventurous, very kind of wild woman. When she was young, she performed for a while as a stunt surfer, which meant that like when a surfer would be in the ocean, she would climb on top of their shoulders and like do these sort of extra little stunts on top while they were riding the wave. And she, you know, did this really kind of dangerous deep sea fishing off the coast of Oregon. And she was an artist and just lived this pretty bold life. And I, by contrast, was a really shy and quiet kid and always kind of uncomfortable in my own skin and didn't really know how I fit into anything. And it was really, really hard when she had her strokes and this really big personality who is kind of the center of all of our lives, you know, changed completely. And she became a person, you know, for whom we were the caretakers then. And so when this opportunity, I was down kind of just interviewing a bunch of the sideshow performers before all this began as a writer and just trying to kind of uncover their story. And so, yeah, when this opportunity kind of arose really surprisingly to actually go perform with them, I thought about her and what choice she would have made. You know, of course she would go perform with a sideshow. And I thought about, in some ways, like holding on to her spirit and sort of carrying it forward and doing something that made me feel really uncomfortable, but would be, you know, a way of sort of honoring her and doing something that I would, you know, love to be able to tell her about.
And what do you think is the main thing that you took away from your season with the sideshow?
I think probably the biggest thing is that I used to have this idea, I guess, that there were some people who were brave and bold and some people who were kind of shy and quiet and fearful. And I just had assumed that I was the kind of fearful kind of person when I was younger. And I really disliked myself. I thought that I was the wrong kind, the kind that other people wouldn't really like. And I had a lot of kind of self-loathing, really. And I think through the experience both of of being with my mom, which was incredibly difficult, but also I had to really relearn a different way of being with her. So through that experience and also through being with the sideshow, I sort of came away with this idea that I could do all of the things that a brave and bold person could do. And it was really just a matter of being afraid of something and doing it anyway. So it wasn't that a person, I think, would not be afraid. It was that, like, it is fearful to swallow fire. It is fearful to be by the bedside of a person who's dying over and over again, but you just do it anyway. And it is going to hurt. It's going to be uncomfortable. It's going to hurt. But you just do it anyway. And so that was a really novel idea to me, that something could be painful and that you could just choose, you could choose it. You could choose the thing that was painful. And I think has been probably one of the most important lessons of my life so far.
Well, it's a beautiful and life-affirming book and also very, very good fun. I suppose my last question has to be, are you tempted to go back on the road?
Oh, man. Well, thank you for saying those nice things about the book. You know, I think about going back on the road sometimes. When I left the season, I sort of, like, you know, dusted my hands and was like, never again. I am so tired and so dirty, never again. And then by about 2 weeks later, I would kind of wake up in the morning with this idea, like, well, what if I learned a trapeze act? Or what if I, you know, just had my own trailer? So I started thinking, like, well, I wouldn't go back in the same way, but maybe in a slightly different way. And so I thought about it. But I think I'm so happy to have had that one season. And now, you know, the rest of the performers who continue to come out year after year and learn all kinds of new acts, I think I'll leave it to them for now. And I'll enjoy my morning coffee in the closed door of my bedroom.
Well, the World of Wonders carries on touring around the United States. And I hope your book means that they'll get plenty more years out of it. Thank you for sharing your amazing story, Tessa Fontaine. And The Electric Woman is out now in print, audio and ebook.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me. It's been great to talk to you, Red.
Sideshows are where people come to see a public display of their private fears, of deformity, of a disruption in the perceived gender binary, of mutation, of disfigurement, of a crossover with the animal world, of being out of proportion. And that is a sideshow's intention, to frame whoever or whatever is on display as being outside the realm of what's normal. For the snake act, it should appear that I have such chemistry with the creature that we are almost one. That's what's interesting to see, the snake-human duo who have overcome the predator-prey divide. I look at the snake. She is moving her head side to side, trying, I'm sure, to find someone to kill. I'm sweating.
The Electric Woman, a memoir in death-defying acts, written and narrated by my guest, Tessa Fontaine. It's out now in paperback, ebook, and audio, wherever you buy your books. And Tessa will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
Would you like to chat over the telephone with a group of like-minded people? RNIB's award-winning telephone social groups are small, friendly, and lots of fun. A great way of making new friends and a chance to socialise without leaving the comfort of your home. Telephone RNIB Talk and Support on 0845 330 3723 or email talkandsupport@rnib.org.uk.
You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come on this week's show, Deborah Harkness leads us into a world of witches and vampires. But first, something that I love in a talking book is when I hear that the narrator is as taken with the story as I am, that we're devouring the pages together. Recently, Robert Kirkwood captured precisely this passion when he interviewed Paul Burchard between recording breaks at the RNIB Talking Book Studio in Glasgow.
Available now in audio from RNIB is The Boy Who Played with Fusion by Tom Clines.
Propulsion, the 9-year-old says, as he leads his dad through the gate of the U.S. Space and Rocket Center. I just want to see the propulsion stuff. Situated next to the Northern Alabama complex, where NASA engineers designed and built the rockets that propelled America's space program, the center showcases the world's most impressive collection of high-flying hardware. Visitors can touch the scorched Apollo 16 command module, tumble spin in a chair that mimics the frictionless vacuum of space, or command a mission in the space shuttle's cockpit simulator. But Taylor Wilson mostly wants to see the museum's prize piece, the massive Saturn V rocket that launched mankind to the moon.
A new book available from RNIB Talking Books is The Boy Who Played with Fusion by Tom Clines. And the person who read that for RNIB is Paul Butchard, and he joins me now.
Hi there. How you doing?
Tell us about The Boy Who Played with Fusion.
It's a phenomenal book. I didn't know about this young man. It's about a boy. He's now a young man of 21, but his name is Taylor Wilson. And he was born and raised initially in Arkansas, just near the Texas border in Texarkana. And he's extremely bright, and so is his younger brother. But what happened is that when he was about 10 years old, his grandmother took him to the bookstore. He'd already wanted to be an astronaut, and he'd already figured out everything you needed to know practically about rocket mechanics. He was shooting off rockets, making his own rockets. He knew he'd been to visit NASA and the, you know, where the Saturn V rocket is in Huntsville, Alabama. But his grandmother said, well, let's go and get you a book for your birthday. So he bought a book called The Radioactive Boy Scout, which is a story about a guy called Han, who ended up trying to build a nuclear reactor in his shed in the backyard. And it went horribly wrong for him. But Taylor, instead of thinking, oh, that's a terrible thing, thought to himself, actually, I could do that. And I'm a lot more safe-minded than he is. And so he just became obsessed with nuclear fusion technology. And nuclear fission is what's normally used, where you split atoms. Mm. But nuclear fusion is where you take two very, very light atoms, like hydrogen, and you shoot them with a lot of neutrons and try and make two hydrogen atoms fuse into helium. And they make a new helium atom, which is just a little bit heavier, but it lets off quite a bit of energy when they do that, when the two fuse together. Anyway, The Boy Who Played with Fusion is an amazing story about this kid, Taylor Wilson, growing up initially in Texarkana in Arkansas, and becoming, by the age of 14, the youngest person ever to create a fusion reactor and achieve nuclear fusion. And he didn't stop there. He's 21 now.
He did actually achieve it then.
Yeah, he totally achieved it by the time he was 14 years old at the University of Nevada at Reno. His parents took him eventually from Arkansas to a high school in Reno, Nevada. That's north of Las Vegas, near Lake Tahoe in Nevada. And it's called the Davidson Academy. And at that time, the kids who were there were encouraged to just follow their passions. And then they were kind of kept online and on stream for the rest of their studies, but they were allowed to go as far as they wanted in their own passions. So he was taking university advanced higher nuclear physics, and he had two great mentors at the university who were nuclear physicists and one guy who was also a terrific scrounger of materials and builder of stuff. And Taylor designed and with their help got this thing built and machined and built, a small fusion generator right in the basement of the University of Nevada Reno Physics Department.
Now, it's nonfiction and it's a science book. Did that make it quite difficult to read?
Well, there is a lot of kind of scientific stuff in it, but a lot of it's tongue-in-cheek, but it doesn't talk down to you. I mean, it is an interesting book and you have to really concentrate. And it took a lot to read it, actually, because he writes a lot of long sentences, which I had to break up in little bits so that I could be sure I understood what I was talking about. But yeah, it's a terrific book. I really would recommend it because he doesn't just tell this boy's story. He tries to extrapolate it into the fact that really, as we now know and as research has found out, just about everyone can actually excel in some area or other, and some in many areas. So he is an extraordinary young man, but he's not by any means alone. And it's about the philosophy and the sorts of things that societies need to do to allow their best and brightest and their apparently average to excel, to find what they love and to excel.
There's something about your accent. We're recording this in Glasgow. We're in the Glasgow studios. How did you end up here?
Well, I'm the only actor who ever left Hollywood, based himself in Glasgow, and lived to tell about it. And I won't tell you the long story, but the short story is that I was on a picture with Roy Scheider, the late Roy Scheider from Jaws, about 10, 12 years ago. And another guy and I were on it, and Roy turns to us and says, "One of you two guys lives in Glasgow?" And I said, "Yeah, that's me." And he said, "Why?" So I told him, and he said, "Yeah, but come on." So then I said, "Well, then I met a girl and fell in love." "Ah, the plot thins," he said. So I'm still here, but I mostly work in London and around London. But when I'm in Glasgow, I'm very fortunate that the RNIB, who do produce talking books here in Glasgow, call me and offer me wonderful things like The Boy Who Played with Fusion.
Okay, give us a bit. I believe this is about a nuclear warhead gone missing.
Yes, and there are many of them, apparently. I'm going to read a little bit from the book here so you get a flavor of some of it. As the strategy of nuclear deterrence catalyzed a frightening, paranoia-driven arms race, the bombs got bigger and more numerous, and the number of broken arrows, incidents in which nuclear weapons were accidentally lost, began to grow. A lost nuke is unsettling enough. Even more unsettling is the fact that it happened so often that the armed forces actually needed to coin a term for it. Now, what Taylor did is he wrote away to the Department of Defense and so on to get reports under the Freedom of Information Act as to where any of these incidents might have happened. Mm. And then he would go out and dig for stuff, digs for bomb shards and anything else. He just loves nuclear stuff. So he's reading through this this one report. One night, while Taylor was reading through a partially redacted Pentagon accident report, he came across an incident that stood out for its disturbing similarity to the absurdist fiction of Dr. Strangelove. What also stood out was its location. Taylor immediately picked up the phone. "Carl," he said, "there's a broken arrow right in your backyard." And then finally, according to the cleanup report, the crater was filled and the contamination completely removed. "You kind of got to read between the lines," Taylor says. "Completely removed" means something like, "We bulldozed most of the stuff into the crater, covered it, and then took a cursory look around." "Unrecovered" means they decided it wasn't worth the effort.
The Boy Who Played with Fusion. By the age of 11, Taylor had mastered the science of rocket propulsion. At 13, his grandmother's cancer diagnosis drove him to investigate medical uses for radioactive isotopes. And at 14, Wilson became the youngest person in history to achieve nuclear fusion. At the age of 17, Wilson is winning international science competitions with devices designed to prevent terrorists from shipping radioactive material into the US. How could someone so young achieve so much? And what can Wilson's story teach parents and teachers about how to support high-achieving children? In this book, science journalist Tom Clines follows Taylor Wilson's extraordinary journey. The Boy Who Played with Fusion will delight anyone who believes in the ability of gifted children to change the world. And as we've said, it's available in audio from RNIB libraries. And Paul, thank you so much for joining me today.
It's been a delight. Thank you so much.
There's another book for my reading list. My thanks to Robert and Paul. The Boy Who Played with Fusion by Tom Clines is TB22533. Have you found a hidden gem in the library that you'd like to share, or maybe a favourite narrator that you'd love to listen to? Why not drop us a line via the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you. You're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio. A Discovery of Witches is the first book in the hugely successful All Souls trilogy written by Deborah Harkness. The author, who's also a professor of history at the University of Southern California, specializing in early science and alchemy, has been closely involved with adapting her book for TV. It's a tale of witches and vampires, ancient rivalries, and a quest for arcane knowledge that unfolds in modern-day Oxford and draws in a magical cast of characters. Deborah joined me to tell me more, and I started by asking her about the audio versions of her books.
I am a big fan of the audiobooks, as a matter of fact. So it's something that I'm sort of I'm a passionate advocate for, and they're just more and more popular these days.
So you listen to them yourself then, do you?
I do. I have sometimes been found sitting in my own driveway with the audiobook on because it kind of comes up on a random shuffle on my iPad and and into the car. And I've been known to sit there and listen entranced and think, wait a minute, you wrote this. You know how this goes. Why are you sitting here? But the performance is really something. So,
how has adapting A Discovery of Witches for TV compared with writing or actually even listening to the book?
Well, it's an amazing treat, really, because the things that I really try to describe, how it looks, how it smells, how it sounds. I'm a very sort of sensory writer, and I like to emphasize those things. I tend to remember places by smell rather than sight, actually. So the first thing I think of when I think of Oxford is I think of the smell of the Covered Market. And so, you know, to see sort of the real visual emphasis that's in the show, and to know that something I took me 2 pages to describe, they can show in a second and a half, is a real treat. And it's just also just obviously incredibly exciting and unexpected to have enough interest in your stories that someone does want to make a television program out of it.
And you mentioned that the book starts off in Oxford. What do you think it is about Oxford that has inspired so many fantasy writers, from Lewis Carroll to Philip Pullman and Tolkien?
Well, it really is. As someone who spent some time there as an undergraduate and as a postgraduate student, you know, it really is that kind of mystical, magical environment between the bells and the mist and the spires piercing the sky, the color of the stone. There's something just very otherworldly about it, I think. So I'm always a little, have a good chuckle over the sort of the crime shows that take place there, because I think, my goodness, awful lot of murders happening in Thames Valley based on that. But for me, it's more that it's sort of that otherworldly, timeless quality to the city, I think, has a real grip on the imagination.
You're clearly a bit of an Anglophile, obviously, you know, Inspector Morse. What led you to Oxford in the first place?
Well, my mum is from Liverpool, so I'm actually half British. And when I was studying as an undergraduate, there was a study abroad program in Oxford. And I took that opportunity. I was about 20, just over 20 years old. And it was my first long time away from home and a long time away from America. And I just fell hard in love with Oxford.
And the UK in general. I first came across you from your book, The Jewel House.
Goodness, Red, you get extra credit for that. My goodness.
Well, I'm old. Your history of the Elizabethan scientific revolution. And it's a fascinating study in alchemy, which we tend to look at almost as witchcraft now, but which was cutting-edge technology back then.
Absolutely. And you know, alchemy has an awful lot of science in it, as do many of the things that we might think of as, you know, magical, horoscopes, astrology, had a real basis in medieval astronomy. You couldn't actually do one without the other. And there's a very complicated relationship between magic and science. We should never forget that Isaac Newton may have developed calculus in a breathtaking 18 days, but he also spent decades on alchemy experiments. So we see them as a bit oppositional, but in fact, they have a very long, twisted relationship.
And I suppose that an Amazonian tribesman might find coming to our 21st century world and being able to speak by mobile phones or turn on lights quite alchemical himself.
Absolutely. You know, really, magic is action at a distance. You know, how can someone over here saying these words have an effect over there on that person? Well, you know, what we're doing is magical. I'm sitting in a studio in London and somehow, you know, I'm talking to you and I don't see you and I can hear you only. And that would be magic for somebody who lived a few centuries ago.
So what led you from writing historical studies of science and alchemy to turning to fiction?
I was, honestly, about 10 years ago, to this day, I was on holiday with my family, and I just finished the Jewel House, actually, and I was walking through an airport, and I saw that there was just an entire wall of books that were about demons, witches, vampires, shapeshifters, you name it. And I looked at that wall, and I thought about my research subjects in the Jewel House, and I thought, well, this is a wall that would have really interested them. I mean, you've read The Jewel House, so you know that people really believed that their neighbor could be a witch or exercise magical powers. But here was this very modern set of books. And yes, they were fictional, but it made it out as though these people were really all around us all the time. And I started thinking, well, what if my research subjects in The Jewel House were right? What if the magic really does exist? What if there really are witches and vampires and demons? What would they do for a living? How would they fall in love? Would they tell anyone? And more importantly, why don't I know any? Because they would be very interesting friends. So that was the genesis for Discovery of Witches, you know, and here we are 10 years later looking at the television premiere. So it's been a kind of magical journey on its own.
Unlike some of those books from a decade ago, your books are firmly aimed at a more grown-up audience. Your characters, your protagonists are both in their 30s. Well, one of them's 1,530 years old. But
minor detail.
Yeah, they're definitely grown-ups. They have grown-up issues to deal with. And actually, I think you handle discrimination of race, gender, and difference in a very grown-up way in the book.
Yeah, well, this was one of the great conundrums when I saw that wall. I just thought, well, wait a minute. These all make it sound as though everyone would be overjoyed if their child or their loved one came home with a vampire boyfriend. And I know people who aren't invited back home because they came home with a same-sex partner or someone of a different race or religion. Because really, humans often have a real hard, very hard on people who are different. And so the vampire, the witch, the demon gave me a way of addressing that contradiction in human society, that on the one hand, we're drawn to the exotic. On the other hand, in our daily lives, we're often very, very sort of aggravated and annoyed when somebody who's different is around us. It kind of disturbs our equilibrium. And I think that we all need to be a little bit more empathetic to people who aren't like us. And this gave me a great way to sort of make that case.
It's funny, I've always wondered whether we've created vampires and witches and werewolves to segregate people who are different, to demonize them, I suppose. And actually what you're saying is that by using vampires, werewolves and witches, we can help understand the differences in our own society in a fictional way.
Absolutely. They're monsters to think with. So we can project all of our anxieties. You know, somebody like the vampire. The vampire does not remain fixed. Their character changes over time. So does the witch. So does the demon. And you can link those changes to the cultural anxieties of that moment. To look at Anne Rice's vampires as an example, you know, those are the vampires of the 80s. The concerns are about how wealthy are they, about the blood itself, the transfer of blood. This was in the middle of the AIDS, you know, epidemic and concerns about that. And so it's normal for these sort of mythical characters to shift and change. These are very much modern versions of the witch, the vampire and the demon that you'll see in A Discovery of Witches on the television screen.
I was searching to see if I could find any blind vampires. A lot of us who've got sight loss actually find it quite difficult to go out in bright sunlight and negotiate our way around and actually sometimes feel a little bit more comfortable in the dark. You couldn't enlighten me on that at all, could you?
Well, you raise a very interesting issue. I have a new book coming out a few days after the television show called Time's Convert, and you will find a vampire with sight issues in the book. Someone who is light struck is the word that I came up with. So that might be a fun thing for some of your listeners to look out for in the future. But I am really interested in the ways that the senses play into a vampire's existence. They have heightened senses, specifically sight. But I also thought, well, okay, but what about a vampire who didn't have that? What if something in their transformation meant that they had a visual challenge of some sort? How would that actually play out in their life? So to be continued, as they say.
Fantastic. Well, I know that you're continuing with the series with some of the minor characters as well. The trilogy is a trilogy within itself, isn't it? So the books that you're writing are, well, spin-offs.
Absolutely. For another word. Yeah. What happened is that I just had a whole lot of backstory that readers told me they wanted to hear about. So I've spent the last couple of years trying to figure out how I could both sort of advance the story of the main characters of Diana and Matthew while at the same time delving into some of these other characters' pasts. And I think I've come up with a sort of way to do that with Times Convert. But yeah, the trilogy itself, that A Discovery of Witches really kicks off, is its own thing. It's a complete set of three stories. It ends there with a resolution. So nobody needs to worry that this is a trilogy that will have 15 books in it, because the trilogy itself is done and dusted, as they say.
And final question, have you got a historical tome on the back burner, or have you sold your soul to fiction?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I'm still supposed to be writing a book on early experimentation in the Royal Society, but it's taking a little bit longer than I had anticipated to finish it, what with the television show and the books and all this excitement. But I suppose I will get back into the library one day and finish up with that as well.
Deborah Harkness, thanks so much for joining me on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you so much, Red. It's been a real treat.
The leather-bound volume was nothing remarkable. To any ordinary historian, it would have looked no different from hundreds of other manuscripts in Oxford's Bodleian Library, ancient and worn. But I knew there was something odd about it from the moment I collected it. Duke Humphrey's reading room was deserted on this late September afternoon, and requests for library materials were filled quickly now that the summer crush of visiting scholars was over, and the madness of the fall term had not yet begun. Even so, I was surprised when Sean stopped me at the call desk.
"Dr. Bishop, your manuscripts are up," he whispered,
voice tinged with a touch of mischief. The front of his Argyle sweater was streaked with the rusty traces of old leather bindings, and he brushed at it self-consciously. A lock of sandy hair tumbled over his forehead when he did. "Thanks," I said, flashing him a grateful smile. I was flagrantly disregarding the rules limiting the number of books a scholar could call in a single day. Sean, who'd shared many a drink with me in the pink stuccoed pub across the street in our graduate student days, had been filling my requests without complaint for more than a week.
"And stop calling me Dr. Bishop. I always think you're talking to someone else."
He grinned back and slid the manuscripts, all containing fine examples of alchemical illustrations from the Bodleian's collections, over his battered oak desk, each one tucked into a protective gray cardboard box.
"Oh, there's one more."
Sean disappeared into the cage for a moment and returned with a thick, quarto-sized manuscript bound simply in mottled calfskin. He laid it on top of the pile and stooped to inspect it. The thin gold rims of his glasses sparked in the dim light provided by the old bronze reading lamp that was attached to a shelf.
"This one's not been cooled up for a while. I'll make a note that it needs to be boxed after you return it."
"Do you want me to remind you?"
"No, already made a note here."
Sean tapped his head with his fingertips.
"Your mind must be better organized than mine."
My smile widened. Sean looked at me shyly and tugged on the call slip, but it remained where it was, lodged between the cover and the first pages.
"This one doesn't want to let go," he commented.
Muffled voices chattered in my ear, intruding on the familiar hush of the room. "Did you hear that?" I looked around, puzzled by the strange sounds.
"What?"
Sean replied, looking up from the manuscript. Traces of gilt shone along its edges and caught my eye, but those faded touches of gold could not account for a faint, iridescent shimmer that seemed to be escaping from between the pages. I blinked.
"Nothing."
I hastily drew the manuscript toward me, my skin prickling when it made contact with the leather.
A Discovery of Witches, narrated by Imogen Church, is TV 18660. The TV adaptation starts on Sky One this week in the UK and does have audio description. Thanks to Deborah Harkness. The complete set of her All Souls trilogy is available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB library, where you'll also find her non-fiction book, The Jewel House, Elizabethan London and the Scientific Revolution. Now it's back to Tessa Fontaine for the books of her life. Tessa, was there a book that you read as a child or a young woman that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
Yes. There are so many books that made me a great lover of reading and writing. But I think the one that has continued to linger in my mind is a book called Hatchet by Gary Paulsen. And it's, a middle grade reader's book, so maybe for 8 to 10 year olds or so. And it's a story of a young boy whose parents are just divorced, and he's in a little plane flying over the Canadian wilderness to see his father, I think. And the plane crashes, and he survives, and he has to learn to live in the Canadian wilderness by himself. He has to learn to survive, and he only has his hatchet. It's the first book I remember reading and feeling so gripped by the story and by what a child was able to do. Like, you know, you don't really think of children as having to really survive for their lives in that way. And so it was an astonishing book. And also coming from, you know, divorced parents and sort of a confusing family life, I really connected to sort of the emotional story. So yeah, that Hatchet by Gary Paulsen was a really early influence for sure.
Unfortunately, Hatchet by Gary Paulsen is only available in print and ebook format and isn't in the RNIB library. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Yeah, there is a book, a novel called The Round House by Louise Erdrich. It does two things, I think, really masterfully. One is it's set on a Native American reservation, and so it's kind of like builds this really interesting portrait of what life is like there. But it's also this really fast-paced, fascinating sort of mystery that's unraveling. So it's both, you know, it's both really a page turner as you're trying to figure out what has happened and who has done it. But it's also really gorgeously written and set in a really interesting setting, and the characters are really wonderful, and it kind of goes into these legends and dreams sometimes. And it's just overall a pretty magnificent book.
Women don't realize how much store men set on the regularity of their habits. We absorb their comings and goings into our bodies, their rhythms into our bones. Our pulse is set to theirs. As always, on a weekend afternoon, we were waiting for my mother to start us ticking away on the evening. And so, you see, her absence stopped time. What should we do? We both said at once, which was again upsetting, but at least my father, seeing me unnerved, took charge. Let's go find her, he said. And even then, as I threw on my jacket, I was glad that he was so definite. Find her. Not just look for her, not search. We would go out and find her. The cars had a flat, he declared. She probably drove someone home, and the cars had a flat. These damn roads. We'll walk down and borrow your uncle's car and go find her. Find her again.
The Roundhouse by Louise Erdrich is available in print, ebook, and audio formats, and is narrated by Gary Farmer. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Yeah, I just finished yesterday, actually, a new book by Madeline Miller, and it's called Circe. She has studied classics and has written, she wrote The Song of Achilles a few years ago. And Circe is a book that sort of imagines the life of the goddess Circe, who is mentioned kind of across mythology, and imagines like the entirety of her life. So it's sort of especially taking these moments where she's mentioned in the Odyssey, where Odysseus comes to this island, and all we knew about her was that she turned men to pigs, and then, you know, she took Odysseus as a lover. But then this is sort of like, what would, like, who is a woman? What is the backstory of this woman? What is the rest of the story? And the tone, it's all written from her point of view, you know, fictionally, obviously. But the tone is really masterful, and it's kind of like an epic poem in its own right. So it goes sort of through all these different journeys in her life, and it's totally compulsively readable and really beautiful.
"It is marriage," she said to him, "or nothing. And if it is marriage, be sure. You may have what girls you like in the field, but you will bring none home, for only I will hold sway in your halls. Conditions, constrainment. These were novelties to my father, and gods love nothing more than novelty. A bargain," he said, and gave her a necklace to seal it, one of his own making, strung with beads of rarest amber. Later, when I was born, he gave her a second strand, and another for each of my three siblings. I do not know what she treasured more, the luminous beads themselves or the envy of her sisters when she wore them. I think she would have gone right on collecting them into eternity until they hung from her neck like a yoke on an ox if the high gods had not stopped her. By then they had learned what the four of us were. 'You may have other children,' they told her, 'only not with him.' But other husbands did not give amber beads. It was the only time I ever saw her weep."
Circe by Madeline Miller is available commercially in print, ebook, and audio, narrated by Perdita Weeks. Tessa Fontaine, thank you so much for sharing your obvious love of reading and your amazing story with the Read On listeners.
Oh, it's really my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks to Tessa Fontaine. Don't forget that you can share the books of your life by emailing us at the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not head to our Audio Boom page? All our past shows are there, complete with book news, reviews, and exclusive author interviews. You'll find a link on the front page of our website, rnibconnectradio.org.uk. Or you can find producer Robert on Twitter at @talking_books. Farewell until next week, and remember to read on.